We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us. Hope you're having a great weekend. We've got a lot of things to talk about over the next hour, including new findings on the impact of screen time on our children's brains, and we'll find out what are the most common calls received at the Missouri Poison Center. We'll also hear about a new way to treat pulmonary embolism. But first, let's start the show the way we do every week with our co-host, SLU Cares Dr. Nirav Patel. Dr. Patel is an infectious diseases specialist. He's also the chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Patel, thanks for coming in again.
As always, great to be here.
Let's start out with an update on the romaine lettuce situation.
The FDA has identified one source of the E. coli outbreak, a water reservoir at Adam Brothers Farms in Santa Barbara County, California, but they don't think that's the only source.
We continue to advise avoiding romaine lettuce from Monterey, San Benito, and Santa Barbara counties in California.
The FDA's Stephen Ostroff says you'll notice romaine lettuce back on store shelves, and the packaging should have where the lettuce is from. He says, if it does not, don't eat it. Sabrina Cupid for CBS News Atlanta.
So how are you feeling about lettuce these days?
I think that the identification of the areas where the infected romaine lettuce is coming from is important. In this case, it looks like it's a reservoir, at least one, maybe others, that have been contaminated, probably from agricultural animal waste products, where the bacteria gets into the water, and then that water is used as irrigation for farming purposes and then gets into plants. You know, things like lettuce, you might wash them, you might rinse them, but you're not going to cook it, and that increases the risk. And sometimes once the bacteria gets integrated into the stem and the leaf material of the plant, you're going to have potential for infection.
And another warning this week, especially time for the holiday season, about eating raw cookie dough.
Playing Cookie Monster this month?
C is for cookie.
Get your fingers out of the dough. The CDC is warning it can make you sick. Health officials say raw flour and eggs can cause life-threatening diseases like E. coli. 2 years ago, 63 people got sick in an outbreak linked to raw flour, which isn't treated to kill E. coli and other germs. Raw eggs in the batter can cause salmonella poisoning. Simple solution? Wait until your cookies are baked. It kills off contaminants in both flour and eggs. Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News.
Okay, I gotta admit, I do sneak some cookie dough when my wife is making cookies, but not that much. Should we be concerned?
Yeah, that's not a good plan, Fred. I think you got to be careful. The bacteria are really small, so eating a small amount can still expose you to a lot of bacterial load. I think the key is that you want to make sure that the atoms are cooked, fully cooked, and that would kill off all the bacteria that is potentially there. The Salmonella, E. coli, these types of bugs are fairly easily killed by heating and cooking, but when they're not cooked, you can be at risk.
And I've read that commercially made cookie dough is usually safe to eat or to taste because it doesn't contain raw eggs and the flour is heat treated. Is that true?
Well, I think that it depends on the situation. So if you want to get those, you know, ice cream, for example, that's cookie dough flavored or little cookie dough flavoring bits that are around, I think those are different and are okay to consume. The point here is that if you're making cookies at home from scratch, you're going to get the eggs, you're going to get the flour, you're going to mix that up. And I think that that's where the risk is.
We found out about a new test this past week that might help us determine how long we're going to live. I wanted you to hear about it and react to it. Tell me what you think about this.
Want to know rather quickly whether you're at risk of an early death? Well, try to walk quickly up four flights of stairs. Can't do it? Well, a five-year study of nearly 13,000 people found that those who struggled with the stairs were three times more likely to die from heart disease and twice as likely to die from cancer. The key to the test is being able to get up the four flights of stairs without stopping for a break. Jim Shanaby, CBS News.
How true is that?
I think that the key here is that it's a reflection of your cardiovascular health. So I think it's a quick and easy way to try to identify a general risk group. It probably is not what we call a perfect test. It's going to miss some people that are at risk, and it's going to probably reassure folks that may still be at risk. So I would not depend on it exclusively, but it's something quick and easy we could fairly easily do, maybe even at home. Going up and down a couple of flights of stairs, you probably know whether you're getting winded or not. And if you are, that might suggest that your cardiovascular fitness is compromised, and doing a little bit of or increasing your cardiovascular exercise would help.
We're talking with Sluk Harris, Dr. Nirav Patel. He's the chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also an infectious diseases specialist. Speaking about cardiovascular health, we heard this week about more concerns with women and their different symptoms for heart attacks.
Women experiencing a heart attack wait an average of 37 minutes longer than men to call for help. Researchers in Switzerland say women may wait longer because the common symptoms for women, pain in the back, shoulder, or stomach, are not as well known as the traditionally male symptoms of pain in the chest and left arm.
Well, I would say anecdotally we've seen this, and I think that the key here is that people experience symptoms differently, and we need to appreciate those differences. There's these gender differences that haven't really been studied as much, and I think are coming to light nowadays with increasing research such as this. And I think they need to be educated and disseminated amongst folks so that people know what symptoms to look out for. If you're male, you might have one cohort of symptoms, and if you're female, you might experience other ones. And both are important and could reflect risk.
Let's go over some of the main symptoms of a heart attack in men.
So what would be typically described as the traditional symptoms of heart attack are chest pressure or tightness, feeling like there's an elephant sitting on your chest, having trouble breathing or catching your breath, and then pain in your neck on the left side or left shoulder or radiating down your arm. Those are the, if you want to say, traditional signs of a heart attack, and they can be in men and women.
But specifically for women, the symptoms might be...
Absolutely. In women, the symptoms might be different, may not be as severe, or may be more generalized. In women, they may be more likely to experience back pain. They may be more likely to have nausea and vomiting or stomach pain in the middle of their stomach rather than towards the left or up in the chest again. And then women can have lightheadedness and breaking out into a cold sweat as well.
Let's talk about a new study regarding secondhand smoke. Millions of Americans are still breathing in someone else's smoke, and that's putting their health at risk.
58 million Americans are exposed to secondhand smoke, according to Brian King with the CDC here in Atlanta, and his main concern for the nation's children.
There is no risk-free level of secondhand smoke, and that's why today's findings are particularly concerning to us.
He says the home is the main place where children are exposed to the harmful smoke, and when it comes to children, he says secondhand smoke can cause ear infections, respiratory infections, and even sudden death syndrome. 41,000 Americans die from secondhand smoke exposure every year here in the United States. Sabrina Cupid for CBS News, Atlanta.
What do you want people to know about secondhand smoke?
Well, I think that the key message is that there's no safe amount of secondhand smoke. And especially in children whose lungs and respiratory system is still developing, the exposure to the smoke, which has proven carcinogens and what are called mutagens, things that cause mutations in cells, chemicals that can cause damage to the growing cells, that's very important because then that that damage could be carried on. And so I think the key message of no safe amount of secondhand smoke, especially for children, is the most important message here.
And what about vaping fumes? Is that the same as cigarette smoke or secondhand smoke?
I think the question is still out on vaping, and I say that in a scientific way, but I want to emphasize that that's because we haven't done enough research. That doesn't mean that it's safe or not safe. It just means that we don't know. And I think that when we say that we don't know in science, that means it's okay. And I think that that's clearly not the case. I think that there's going to be chemicals that have been shown to be present in vaping that are also present in cigarette smoke and that have been shown to cause injury, damage. The concentrations are much lower. It's maybe different chemical compounds. So the question is out, is still there, but I would not assume that this is somehow safer.
Dr. Patel, thanks for your time. Appreciate it. Come back at the end of the show for our health tip of the week.
Thanks. I'll be here.
SLUK, here's Dr. Nirav Patel, is the Chief Medical Officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up next, we'll get the latest on that new study involving kids and screen time. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. New research aimed at understanding the impact of screen time on adolescent brains is already showing some fascinating results. The National Institutes of Health study is following more than 11,000 children over a decade. In early testing, researchers found significant differences in brain chemistry for kids who had at least 7 hours of screen time a day compared to kids who used screens less. Here's part of Anderson Cooper's report that he did on the study last weekend on 60 Minutes.
Until recently, it was impossible to see what happens inside a young brain when a person is focused on a mobile device.
Look.
But now, scientists at the University of California, San Diego, have hacked that problem.
How often do you have young people come in for the MRIs?
So as often as we possibly can.
Dr. Kara Baggett is an investigator on that $300 million NIH study. Her team is scanning teenagers' brains as they follow Instagram, the most popular social media app. When we met 18-year-old Roxy Schimpf, she was about to participate in Dr. Baggett's study.
How much time do you actually spend on screens?
I check my phone pretty regularly, I'd say.
What's pretty regularly?
Every at least 10 to 20 minutes.
Is that a conservative estimate?
Probably.
She can't take her phone into the MRI because of the powerful magnets in the machine. So a mirror has been placed above her face to allow her to look across the room at a movie screen displaying images from her Instagram account. This way, Dr. Baggett can see exactly which parts of the brain's reward system are most active while using social media.
So you can actually see a part of the brain light up when you're feeling good?
Yes, from in the scanner.
In the scanner?
Yeah.
Joining us now to talk more about this study is SLUK Care's Dr. Ken Haller. He's a pediatrician at SSM Health, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Dr. Haller, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Tell us more about this study. What did it find?
Well, this does seem to be an ongoing study, and what it looks at is, what sort of effects does the does long-term exposure to media, particularly visual media, have on the brains of children? And at this point, it's really hard to say what this is going to mean in the long term. My understanding is that this study is going to go on for another decade, and of course, this brings up the kind of questions that often occur in medicine. And in pediatrics in particular, when a new technology comes along, people say, what exactly does it mean for my kid? And the answer is often, well, we really don't know because it just hasn't been around long enough. So this is going to be going on for quite a while. But these early findings are interesting. And again, nobody quite knows exactly what they mean. So I think what we need to do is fall back on what we do know about kids and media use. The main thing that I think is a take-home message for parents is that it really is important to monitor their media intake and to discuss their media intake with them, and also to make sure that media doesn't take the place of human interaction. Kids simply do not learn anything, any skills from media. They don't really learn about language. They don't really learn about human interactions. You need another human being. At least at this point, a child needs another human being to sit down and talk to them and have conversations with them and look them in the eye. And when a child responds, they need to see another human being reacting to that in real time. The current electronic media simply can't do that. And so what happens is that while media can be very entertaining for kids, it's really not creating those neural connections and those synapses and things that are going to really help them in the long term in terms of interactions with other human beings.
MRIs on some of the children in this study who had a lot of screen time show that they had a thinning of their cortex. What does that mean?
Well, actually, as we as we get older, the cortex does thin somewhat. The cortex is the outer covering of the brain. It's the gray matter. These are the cells that are actually interacting with one another, that to create thought, to create consciousness, things like that. There is some thinning that occurs naturally because we are born with a lot of nerves that we don't need, and eventually some of those will die off as they, as the human brain and the individual human finds, I don't need this nerve or that nerve. So at this point, it's kind of hard to say what exactly that means in the brains of these kids. What's that going to mean in the long term? That's why this study, which is going to go on for about another decade or so, is going to be really important in seeing if that has a long-term effect, or if this is just hastening a normal process that would have happened anyway.
Dr. Haller, what do the current guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend when it comes to screen time for kids?
Well, this has to be a personal decision made between parents and kids. The most important thing about this, particularly for kids who are a little bit older, is making sure that that parents are aware of what kids are watching, of what media they're consuming, and most important, that media is not taking the place of interactions with other human beings, with parents, with siblings, with friends. Kids can sometimes, just fall into a black hole of just spending all their time in front of media, not interacting with other human beings. The younger a child is, the more the Academy is finding from previous studies and what we know already, that having some restrictions on that time is important. The Academy really doesn't recommend any screen time before about a year of age or so, and even after that, no more than about 1 to 2 hours of screen time, past that for kids who are very young. So really, the important thing is to keep in mind that the most important interactions kids can have are with another human being. Visual media, auditory media, really can't take the place of that. And the important thing is to keep in mind that these media should be a tool that we use. We can't become a tool of these media.
We're talking with SLU Cares Dr. Ken Haller. He's a pediatrician at SSM Health Cardinal Glenn and Children's Hospital. Dr. Haller, do you think parents understand how dangerous screen time is for their kids?
Well, at this point, I think that there is a growing concern about screen time, not just because there are just so many screens in kids' lives. It's not just television, which is what was going on when I was growing up. There are also computers, there are tablets, there are telephones, and kids spend so much time on all of them. What's unfortunate is that while there is a growing appreciation that kids are spending more time on media, parents often don't really appreciate how much time they're spending on media. So it's not unusual for families to be sitting around and for everyone to be in their own individual media world, not interacting with each other. So while parents may have some intellectual appreciation that media is not good for kids, it's really important for them to set an example and limit their media use. And when kids are around, for them to put down their own phones and have conversations with kids and do things with them out in the real world.
Do you know, is there any help out there for parents, any special apps or anything to help you keep an eye on how much time your kids spend on the phone?
It is interesting because a lot of companies are now allowing you to figure out how much time you're spending on various apps. My iPhone is now telling me how much time I spend on my iPhone looking at stuff this week, and sometimes I'm really surprised at how much that is. So there are apps that where you can figure out how much time you're spending on, not just on various apps, but on using a particular device. And again, the more time you're spending on that, the less you're spending with other human beings. So one thing that's also really important for parents is to really take some control of their children's devices, to make sure that parental controls are set in place to allow, in terms of what sort of sites they can go to, but also looking into these things and looking in, to see how much time they are spending on on various apps and on various media, and those things are more and more available.
So then your bottom line advice to parents is what?
My bottom line advice to parents is to be aware of how much time your kids are spending on media and not allowing media to take the place of interactions with other human beings. And above all, for parents to set a good example when it comes to media. Put down the phone, put down the tablet, everyone go out to the park and just have a good time together.
Dr. Haller, thanks a lot for your time. Really do appreciate it.
Thanks, Fred. Take care.
SLU Cares' Dr. Ken Haller is a pediatrician at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Coming up, we'll talk with the folks at the Missouri Poison Center and find out what kind of calls they've been getting lately. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. 2 years ago, the 55 U.S. Poison Control Centers provided telephone guidance for nearly 2.2 million human poison exposures. That's one exposure every 14 seconds. Here to talk with us about that is Julie Weber. She's director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Not a problem. I know it was the beginning of this year, back in January, where we heard a lot about Tide Pod problems and kids eating Tide Pods and getting sick from that. Give us an update. What are you hearing about that lately?
I'm really happy to report that our exposures to the teens and younger children eating the Tide Pods has gone down. It's not totally gone, but really a decrease that the adolescents are seeing. This is a problem and not a good challenge to take. One of our concerns, though, that we'd like to mention and get to everybody's home is that Tide's actually coming out with a new packaging, and it's supposed to be more eco-friendly, but it's going to be the Tide laundry detergent that is in a box. And what concerns us about that is that the box looks very similar to like wine in a box. It is clearly marked, but for those who can't read or know the difference, it has a similar spigot for dispensing, and it's going to be another potential risk if we don't keep this up high and away from children, as well as just for adults, you know, who might be going to grab something and it's not reading the packaging well.
Do you get a lot of calls about that?
With the Tide, it's going to be, with lookalikes, we get just an enormous amount of calls about. There's so many products that look like candy, look like a food substance. And so when manufacturers package things to make it look more fun or like a product that we normally eat, that's when our calls really do go up.
What's the basic advice you give in a case like that?
Our best advice for with children is to always try to keep these products up high, out of their reach, and out of their sight. That's our best prevention method at home. But unfortunately, so many of the exposures when children get into things are when the product's in use. So we can't just even turn our backs for a second. That's how quick they act. And so we really just, again, up high and in a locked cabinet if possible.
What other internet challenges do you hear about from parents that have gone horribly wrong?
Some that we've heard that concern me was, again, with there was a cinnamon challenge, there was a nutmeg challenge, and fortunately those have kind of fallen off. But with these challenges, there's always some medical risk and a choking risk, or it can stop the breathing. And so those challenges just have been really devastating for some children, and we really try to work with the parents and to educate them and to try to get the warnings out to that adolescent group who's really partaking in these challenges.
What about alcohol? Is there something like called the AWOL, Alcohol Without Liquid Challenge?
There is that challenge with the alcohol. Again, I think it was really kind of noted out there that in parties they were doing this, and it was really trying to like kind of soak gummy candies in alcohol. Or another way is alcohol without liquid, like breathing the vaporized fumes. And I think that even gets us into the trends of with the vaping and the Juuls and that. And it's really things that are commonly in our homes. And then, again, another disguise. The jewel looks like a USB device, and it's really becoming a problem with adolescents. And our calls just seem to never go down about vaping and the questions of the different types of things they're putting in those vaping devices.
And your message to parents about vaping is what?
Vaping is really, I think, a gateway. It opens up the doors to children, and it's really kind of hit its all-time high. And with adolescents, we have a problem. With the Juul products, there's some concern that teens will think they're getting a liquid that has no nicotine in it. And pretty well, from my understanding, is the majority of those products still all do have some type of nicotine, and they are becoming addicted to it. And so we really need to look at what our teens are using. If you think they have a USB device, really investigate that, because I've had some that we do our education with, and they look just like something you plug into your computer. And we really want to get it stopped before they even start it. I think we need to sit down and have that conversation of awareness and just what it could lead to.
We're talking with Julie Weber. She's the director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glenn and Children's Hospital. Julie, give us that phone number that people need to have up on the refrigerator in case there's something that comes up and they need to get in touch with you quickly.
Our phone number is 1-800-222-1222, and a person will immediately speak with a registered pharmacist or nurse who's specialized in training for poison information and prevention. They will be able to give you that advice on the phone. It's free, confidential, and the best part is we always offer a follow-up. So we like to check back and make sure things are okay. It isn't just a one-stop call and that's it. We continue to follow with you if you like to get really to make sure that child, or if it's even an adult, are okay.
I wanted to ask you about that. Adults, do you get many calls from adults about adult poisonings?
We actually do. Of our calls, 35% are on adults, and it can be as simple as just an accidental error with their medication to something that happened in the workplace, or an intentional misuse of a product. So we say poisoning span a lifetime, and we're not just for pediatrics. We can help with any age person and help them get the advice they need and the best treatment. The good part about it is we truly are able to keep almost 90% of our exposures at home. That means with just some home first aid and follow-up from one of our specialists, that person can stay at home without an expensive trip to the emergency department.
What about pet medication? Do you ever get any calls about that saying, hey, someone in my family accidentally took my pet's medication?
So often, and they're always so alarmed and afraid. It goes as the simple exposure is they put it in a piece of cheese for the animal to take and the child ate it, to I was talking on the phone and getting ready to give my dog their medication and I took it. And the great thing about it is many medications we use in our pets, we also have as human medications. And very easily we're able to talk with them, find out what medications they're on, look for interactions, and usually we're able to watch them at home without problems.
We're coming up on the start of a new year, and a lot of people want to go on a diet after the holidays. What's your thinking on dietary supplements? Any concerns there?
I have a lot of concern on the dietary supplements, especially because of how they're regulated. And we really have to be cautious about taking these supplements because without those regulations, they can have other products in them. In some studies that they've done, there are actually prescription medications in some of these herbal or supplement products that can lead to some toxicity. So really, when choosing that diet for the new year or what we're doing, it's really diet and exercise and just eating well. I don't think we have to lean to those supplements for our help.
Julie, go over with our listeners some of the tips you have for storing your medicine at home.
So for safe medication storage, we always mention put products up high. And I say a locked cabinet. So often we'll see children climb up and make a little stepladder out of the drawers and get to the top of a refrigerator or get on top of the cabinet itself. So we really want it out of sight and out of mind so they don't get into it. Another thing is when we take our medications, not to take medication in front of children because they see this as a behavior to mimic. And as a child, they often want to mimic the adult and make them happy. Also, we would say don't refer to medicine as candy. We want to treat it as like medicine, give it to the child, and be done with it. We don't want to confuse them because so much of the medicine does have a good flavoring added to it. And then when our backs are turned or we're busy, they can get into it and ingest it. And then also, just with this time of year and so many visitors and purses and grandma's medication and visitors in the house, those medication planners, they easily flip open, and some younger children see them as they can be a rattle or something to play with. And again, if you have guests over, get all the purses, travel bags, all that away from the reach and sight of children so they can stay out of those.
Julie, one more time. Give us the number for the Missouri Poison Center.
It's 1-800-222-1222. As well as we have a website, MissouriPoisonCenter.org, with some great prevention tips. And then, too, if you just need a game to teach children about poisoning in a safe way, and it keeps them busy on the internet there with a good in our kids' zone, there's a lot of activity sheets and a lookalikes game.
Julie, that's all great information. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. And just remember, we're open 24/7 every day of the year, so we're happy to help.
Julie Weber is the director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Well, when we come back, we'll find out about a new option to treat pulmonary embolism. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Specialists at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital have a new non-surgical tool for treating pulmonary embolism. It's called FlowTriever. The technology is used to physically remove clots inside the pulmonary artery that historically have only been treated through drugs. Here to talk more with us about that is SLU Care Vascular and Interventional Radiologist Dr. Kira Bahara-Vahisan at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Vahisan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Vahisan, what is a pulmonary embolism?
A pulmonary embolism is nothing but clot migrating to from any other part of the body, go to the lung, and block the flow to the lung. And obviously, when the block is blocked, the perfusion is down. The oxygenation doesn't happen. So if it is massive, people die instantly. And there's nothing but it's basically the flow to the lung is completely choked.
And so it's sort of like a stroke in your lungs?
Stroke is, yeah, blood supply to the brain is blocked. It's a stroke. This is exactly similar where the oxygenation doesn't happen. Stroke, at least the patient survive and then live with debilitation. But here, if it is massive, they die instantly.
Tell me about this new option to treat pulmonary embolism.
So even with the technology development and others, in the massive subsect, which is usually 5 to 10% of all the pulmonary embolisms, they tend to die 50% of the time, even when we diagnose in the hospital, even if they are in the hospital, there's no technology to fix it because it happens fast. And number two, there's no way we can take and remove those big clots, and these are massive clots sit there. The new technology is basically we go through a small sheet or tube and suck the clot and instantly relieves the patient. Unfortunately, not every center has it. And this is new device, was just released a few months back, and we are one of the centers to use that.
It's called a FlowTriever?
Yes, it is FlowTriever system.
And how does it work? You use a guide wire to thread it through a vein?
Yes, we go through the groin, and then it advances like any other cardiac catheterization, but we go to the lung, and the sheath is advanced, and we use a suction device. It's a hand device to just suck the clot. The average time from the start to the end of the procedure takes 30 minutes. so it's faster procedure. All other procedures, we go break down the clots, and the clots further disintegrate, goes more distally, I would say, more far away, and still blocks the lung. So there's no way we could remove the clots. But this system is very efficient to remove the clot.
How successful has it been?
We just had one patient we used, and that's the first patient. It was instantaneous. The patient was sitting around 80%. If anybody is sitting at saturating oxygen at 80%, they are expected to die in 5 to 10 minutes. We went and removed the clot, removed, and his oxygenation went from 80% to 96% in a minute. And following that, his blood pressure, which was 60 by 40, normal person is 120 by 80. He's 60 by 40, which was close to almost death. But instantaneously, his blood pressure came to 110 by 70. So that was probably the best in 15 years I've seen.
What patients can get this new treatment?
Only massive. As of now, this is FDA approved for massive people. I said three subsect. The mild is nobody noticed. The moderate usually comes, stays in the hospital for 10, 15 days. The third one is they don't survive. This is particularly for those patients who are extremely sick, moving from moderate to severe. And the moment we notice, we can go and remove the clot.
What's recovery like after a treatment like this?
This patient was almost close to death, and he was eating food after 2 hours. He was stepped down from the ICU the next day, but he had several other cardiac issues, so stayed in the hospital. But typically 2 to 3 days in the hospital, and if they don't have any other, you know, health conditions, they can be discharged in 2 to 3 days. Just FYI, in an average pulmonary embolism patient stays 7 to 10 days.
So this technology, the FlowTriever, can turn an almost always fatal disease into one that you can manage.
Yep, we can. What we could not do, and we're usually helpless in these situations, we usually see patients dying on our table. And that's probably, this is one of those tools which can bring them up. And I was fascinated by this technology.
Saluk, here is Dr. Kira Bahar-Vahisyan, is a vascular and interventional radiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Well, it's that time of the show again for our health tip of the week. Here's our co-host, Saluk Care's Dr. Neera Patel. Dr. Patel, what do you have for us?
Well, today we have talked a lot about children. We talked about secondhand smoke. We talked about screen time. We talked about toxins. And I think parental involvement in kids and their development is perhaps the message of the week. I think the knowing what your kids are doing, what they're watching on the screen, I think is important. Their growth and development is still in progress. And so the toxins from secondhand smoke or, again, the screen time that they're facing, all of that can affect their growth and development. And so being an engaged parent is perhaps the biggest thing you can do to help the well-being of your kids.
Dr. Patel, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Saluk, here is Dr. Neera Patel, is the Chief Medical Officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at this same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.